From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and Saeed Erekat, Washington bureau chief at Al-Quds Daily Newspaper. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Special Counsel Robert Mueller spoke publicly for the first time about the recently concluded investigation into Russian election meddling and obstruction of justice by U.S. President Donald Trump and members of his administration. His statement seemed to encourage Congress to take action that Mueller, as an investigator, could not. New Israel elections are scheduled for September after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fails to form a coalition after his recent victory. President Donald Trump took a state visit to Japan that featured Trump in conflict with his hosts on trade and his advisors on North Korea, and a bizarre incident involving a warship named after former U.S. Senator John McCain, and a White House announcement about new tariffs against Mexico bring into question the effectiveness of tariffs within the Trump economic trade policy. Gentlemen, let's start with the Mueller statement. He spoke for the first time, resigning his post as special counsel, and then making a statement that was meant to clarify his reasons for the investigations, what his conclusions were, and what should happen next. And I say meant to clarify quite purposely, because I think there's still some level of confusion or debate, certainly, about what the statement actually said. Dan, let's start with the timing, really. The timing was a surprise to me, and I think most of Washington, yes?
Well, we have a phrase here, you know, out of the blue. We had no reason to expect him to talk. In fact, there'd been negotiations between Robert Mueller, who completed his investigation and nearly 10 weeks ago issued his written report, between him and House committees. In the House of Representatives, the Democrats are in charge of every committee, and they want him to come and testify. And he hadn't agreed to it. And the word we heard was that Mueller didn't want to get involved in a political circus. But he decides that he does want to speak. No questions. Reporters could come to hear him. No questions allowed. And he spoke for about 10 minutes. And he pretty much repeated what was in his report. But I have to say, because it says something about modern politics, sure, nothing he said was brand new, but people don't read a 400-page report. And so to hear the investigator, to hear the man speak, that was impressive. But what did he say? He really wanted to point out Russia did interfere in the U.S. election in 2016, and that he and his team did not reach any conclusion as to whether President Trump obstructed justice by trying to hamper the investigation. Mueller said, you can't prosecute a sitting president anyway, so we didn't reach a conclusion. As people know, the attorney general, who's very close to the president, William Barr, he determined there's no obstruction of justice and nothing to prosecute. And then Mueller said, even if I testify to Congress, I'll never say anything more than what's in the report. That's it. No questions. I'm no longer the special counsel. Goodbye. And that's the way Mueller would like to leave it. It was a little frustrating.
It was very frustrating to me, actually. And when you get to that phrase where he says, we did not determine that there was enough evidence to charge the president. But he also says, had we determined that he was clear and did not commit a crime, we would have said so. There is so much legal parsing in this. Where do you take it?
Well, I think it was significant. I mean, definitely it was frustrating, but it was significant because this is the first we hear from him directly. And as Dan said, you know, he spotlighted the issues that may have been missed and gave it weight and gave it importance. The point that you raised about the president was not found innocent, basically, saying that, look, you know, sure, we could not charge a sitting president, but there are other means. The Constitution allows for other means to go about this, you know, suggesting implicitly or not directly that Congress maybe ought to start some sort of an impeachment process and so on. So all that is very important, very significant, because you don't expect people to read a 400-page report. Very few in Congress probably read it and so on. And those who read it, like Justin Amash and others, made very strong statements against the president.
Oh, yeah, he's the Republican, the one Republican in the House who says you should impeach the president.
That's right, and I may add he's the son of a Palestinian immigrant and a Syrian immigrant, Christian immigrant, to this country. It does bring the issue to the fore. I think it gives the base of the Democratic Party, gave them ammunition to push for more forcefully towards impeachment, and it does put a lot of pressure on Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House.
And here is the thing, Dan. You do have this, I'm calling it now Pelosi's dilemma. It's a situation system where you have a president who's a better victim than Victor. And she knows that very, very well.
Oh, he enjoys being attacked so he can hit back.
Exactly. Right. So it's a growing drumbeat for impeachment, but it is still a minority. And it's a significantly minority.
As we're speaking now, about 50 Democrats in the House of Representatives publicly have said they favor starting an impeachment process. But you know how many Democrats are in the House? 235. So it's not a majority of the Democrats. And their leader, the Speaker Nancy Pelosi, says it's not a good idea.
And here's the other part of the dilemma. What exactly are you looking for in impeachment? Again, we have an investigation that's millions of dollars, months and months, years and years long. What actually is she trying to do? Because she knows that she can't get a conviction in the Senate. She has acknowledged that.
So the House would impeach. Then you'd have a trial in the Senate.
And trial in the Senate. So what actually do you think Pelosi would be looking for, or the Democrats would be looking for, in an impeachment process? More information?
I think if you look up the word impeach in the dictionary, you'll see that it's to actually spoil or mar someone's reputation. So that's what she's looking for. So that Trump will lose in the election in November of next year. So Nancy Pelosi says six House committees should continue their investigations of Donald Trump, his businesses, and other questions as they arise. Do that, and that will give the Democrats a much better chance of winning the White House, whereas a formal impeachment process with hearings may make Americans think that's a bad idea, another waste of money.
So what was the Republican response to this, President Trump's response to it? They say everybody sees their own rainbow.
His response, he kept saying that, you know, there is no collusion. I am innocent. We are in this country. You are innocent until proven guilty. He did not use the kind of bluster that he used in the past. He was, you know, a bit relieved, but also destabilized on this issue.
Well, I don't think it was that mild. I mean, Saeed, I had the impression that the president must have felt that Robert Mueller is a threat. He started portraying Mueller as an enemy. Mueller never liked me. He was an anti-Trumper. His team
was he wanted to stay on the job, and I didn't give it to him.
So that says to me that the president feels a threat.
Yeah, I'm saying that he did not come out strong and say, look, that proves beyond the shadow of a doubt that I am not involved, that I am innocent, that it is a phony charge on Russia and so on, as he did in the past. It was a bit milder in that sense, but he definitely elevated the rhetoric against Mueller.
Do you think that Mueller did a good job with his statement? He probably accomplished what he meant to accomplish, but did he accomplish what needed to be done?
Well, what he wanted to do, apparently, was raise questions. As you say, if you cannot, under the policy of the Justice Department, prosecute a sitting president, then he did want to point out that Congress could take action. I have nothing further to say. So what he accomplished, Michael, was avoiding the political circus. Because if he has his way, Robert Mueller will never testify to Congress, and it'll just be up to Congress, and it'll just be a political debate. But mind you, this could work for President Trump, as he appeals to voters across America with the notion that he's being unfairly investigated. It was a hoax. Let's move on. And of course, in many ways, he's trying to change the subject this past week.
Well, I think there's one thing that we can't debate, that he started his statement with, there was indeed a concerted effort to interfere with the U.S. elections by Russia as a nation state. Right. And we still don't have that confirmation from the White House that that happened. We still don't have action from the Congress to do anything about it. Nothing essentially has changed since the 2016 elections.
I think that that message came clear that Russia did interfere and so on. But also it shows how far the Republicans have gone to basically toe the line, that Lindsey Graham, other leaders of the party. It shows that they are really with him all the way.
And these are guys who have been Russia hawks for decades.
They are Russia hawks for a decade, but on this issue, they're bailed out because everybody's looking after their own job, you know, and it's not really the interest of the country. I mean, I don't want to accuse anyone, but I'm saying everybody wants to be, you know, on good terms with the president, looking for his own
People who have a job in Parliament or in Congress, they want to keep their jobs, and they put aside their usual policy stands, don't they?
Yes. We will take a break. We'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com.
While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. You can also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Revive, Senior Washington Correspondent for I-24 News, and Saeed Arakat, Washington Bureau Chief at Al-Quds Daily Newspaper. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome back. After winning recent elections, Benjamin Netanyahu becomes the first PM in Israeli history to fail to form a coalition after winning an election, which throws a number of puzzle pieces for Middle East stability into the air. Saeed, I'm going to start with you on this topic. Let's start with, what was the issue that kept the coalition from forming?
The issue, as we understand, is between Lieberman and Netanyahu on the issue of drafting or serving in the military.
I'll fill in the name, Avigdor Lieberman.
Avigdor Lieberman. It was over that, at least openly, but definitely there's a great deal of animosity between Lieberman and Netanyahu. The amazing thing, it is conflict between the right wing and the secular right wing and then the religious right wing, you know, the Torah party and the Israel Beituna party. So that is basically the reason they were unable to form a coalition government. But it also tells a story of much deeper dysfunctional reality of Israeli politics. You know, what we see is that smaller parties are gaining a lot more weight than in the past. We see this play out all the time. We are probably headed towards another crisis along the line.
Yeah, my understanding was that it was five seats that made the difference.
Seats that made a difference. But look, you know, when they voted to dissolve the Knesset, it was 74 votes to dissolve the Knesset.
Again, Knesset has 120. You need 61 to pass something. Right. So it turns out that the members of many parties said, oh, to heck with this. Right. Netanyahu appears to have won the election. Right. And then we've had a mess now for more than 6 weeks. And so a majority of the Knesset, the parliament, said, let's go to another election. They hated it, but they're doing it.
In my view, this thing exposed what Netanyahu was all about. He was trying to get immunity, basically. And the little parties and so on, they want to exact their own piece of the pie, and they will not allow them to do that.
Dan?
Well, the specific dispute was whether ultra-Orthodox Jewish men should be required to go to the army. That was the specific issue. Right. And Lieberman, who was defense minister for a while under Netanyahu, he is secular. He says, I'm Jewish, but I'm not religious. I don't pray all the time. However, I think that in Israel, everyone should serve. And so the ultra-Orthodox Jews, they see Lieberman as kind of an enemy. The ultra-Orthodox have their own political parties. Right. They're part of Netanyahu's coalition for more than 10 years, and he wants them and needs them again. And so, you know, he had this clash. How can Netanyahu possibly form a coalition that has both of them? And in the end, he stuck with the ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties. Yeah. And he couldn't make a deal with Lieberman. And he couldn't quite get 61 seats to guarantee that a coalition would be supported. So, it's dysfunctional in Israel. But let's note, and it must be frustrating for you, Saeed, as a Palestinian-American, as a journalist who follows these issues, that the argument in Israel was not, what do we do about the territories captured in 1967? What do we do about Palestinian rights? What do we do about the Donald Trump peace plan if it comes out? Instead, it was, you know, political stuff, little things within Israeli society. Yeah. It's frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. I said dysfunctional. I'm talking about the government and their ability to form coalitions and so on. But look, Israel is functioning quite well. I mean, the economy is doing well. Every other area is doing quite well. They're up and coming and so on as a country and the world. The political crisis is a political crisis. It's among these parties because of the dysfunctional systems, of the weight of the smaller parties. Absent in the last election, and I think in the upcoming election, the Palestinian issue, what are you going to do about the territories? Netanyahu, if you remember, on the eve of the elections on April 9, he came out and said, look, we're going to annex some parts of the West Bank to satisfy the settlers, to gain their vote and so on. I see this trend continuing. I see that as far as, let's say, settlements and annexation of parts of the West Bank, or maybe the whole of the West Bank, will gain more and more common, let's say, agreement within Israeli society and Israeli political
structure. And Saeed and Michael, just keep in mind, foreign reaction to Israel holding the West Bank has always been very important. And still, in general, in Europe, Europeans are very critical of Israel. Palestinians don't have their rights. Often Israel is blamed. But United States policy changed incredibly when Donald Trump became president just over 2 years ago. Trump supports everything that Netanyahu and Israel do. He had no trouble with anything that Netanyahu's done. It was really Trump's idea to confirm and recognize that Israel holds the Golan Heights captured from Syria in 67. Right. And the thought is that if Netanyahu does, Saeed, what you're suggesting, if he does annex parts of the West Bank, that Trump won't have any trouble with it.
I'll throw this out to both of you. Where does the U.S. involvement in the peace process stand? Because you had Jared Kushner in Israel as this dissolution was happening. There were talks that were scheduled to unveil a peace process, which I personally am very curious to see. But Jared Kushner's put together. It appears that is going to be delayed now indefinitely. Netanyahu didn't want anything like that being unveiled during elections previously. And I don't think he wants them to be anything like that to be unveiled with an upcoming election.
Michael, that would be the usual expectation. During an election campaign, you won't have a big diplomatic initiative. But this is a bit different because what Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law in charge of the peace effort, what he decided to do was put out an economic program for Palestinian prosperity. So it's the economic side of the Israeli-Palestinian peace proposal before the political side, which would discuss perhaps borders, how to negotiate them, and whether there should be an independent state of Palestine. So I think the economic meeting set currently, as we speak at least, in Bahrain for June 25 and 26, I think that's going to take place with potential donors and investors getting together in that Arabian Gulf Kingdom, Bahrain. Even Israel may be represented. The Palestinians say they won't go. I think Kushner's determined to at least unveil the economic side.
It will be interesting to see if that actually happened. Yeah. That's another thing. It is up in the air, as we say. These things, these public pieces there.
I believe it will happen, some sort of a conference. Remember, to help Netanyahu, Trump and Pompeo organized a conference in Warsaw last February where they brought in the Arabs and so on. And it was an anti-Iran kind of conference. But it was also to aid Netanyahu. So this can be seen as aiding Netanyahu. But at the time, it could not have been worse, in my opinion. This is doing economics before political is a failed approach because you need to have a political agreement in order to enhance the economy, allow the Palestinians. In my view, as a Palestinian, I don't think that a Palestinian economic problems and so on are a result of lack of investments and so on. It is because of they are restricted under occupation, under siege in Gaza. They cannot move people and goods and so on and talent and all these things. You're not allowed to do anything. So you cannot basically propose an economic solution to a political problem. There is a political problem that's gone on for a very, very long time, and you need to find a solution in order to have viable economic thing. The problem is that this administration sees everything in terms of money and dollars, that it is the panacea to all ills.
I tend to agree with you on both of your points there. Also, to your point, the White House announced that U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton will be meeting with his counterparts from Israel and from Russia to meet, and presumably there would be some political pieces that come out of that.
Oh, that meeting also is basically to help Netanyahu, because as part of his coalition building the other day, he kept mentioning it. He's a big hero. He's managing to get U.S., Russia, and Israel to sit together, which puts Israel, a country of 8 million people, in the big leagues. Right. It's good for him. It's not much that's new to me.
So it's a cult of personality again, as far as that one's concerned.
I just want to add a little thing. I mean, between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, there are roughly 15 million people. Half of them are not Jewish. Half of them are Palestinians. What are you going to do with them? Ultimately, you have to have a political solution for them. They cannot stay in this state of limbo, either a state of their own, or they should at one point become citizens of the country. Trump gave the Golan to Netanyahu. What are you going to do with the people that live in the Golan? Are you going to give them Israeli citizens? I mean, there are some issues that they do these things to help Netanyahu. You mentioned the Golan yesterday. Well, Kushner, on a very bad day for Netanyahu, gave him a map where the president signed the map and had put down an arrow and said, nice.
Kushner and Trump are proud of what they did, as they see to help Israel, obviously to help Netanyahu, and they think it's to advance peace. Because just to give you the White House line for a second, I've heard Jared Kushner say it, we have to recognize realities. Right. One of the realities is the U.S. is a pro-Israel country. So if the whole region would recognize that, they think it would be helpful. Now, back to your question, what do you do for the Palestinians?
I just want to say, look, this group, Kushner, Greenblatt, Friedman, they moved the country, or the Trump administration, moved the country from being pro-Israel to basically adopting extreme right-wing settler values and policies. I mean, that's what they are doing.
We're going to have to leave that one right there. We have a couple of more things to discuss before we leave today. President Trump went to Japan for a state visit. Japan rolled out the red carpet for the Trumps with golf, sumo wrestling, state dinners, as per usual. But the visit was defined by the unexpected, as it usually seems to be with Trump overseas trips. We'll start with you, Dan. The trade policies, where the Trump administration said that they wanted to address the trade imbalance between the U.S. and Japan. Was that an expected statement?
It always is. No, when President Trump travels, he first considers that country. What is its trade balance with the U.S.? Do we buy more from that country or do they buy American goods? They don't buy enough made in the USA. I'm going to talk about it. And he said that that trade imbalance with Japan cannot be sustained. And so we're negotiating for a better deal. But the thing that really hurt his host, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, was President Trump also being asked about the North Korea missile tests recently. And they weren't the kind of long-range missile that could reach America. And so President Trump said, I'm not bothered. Some of my officials are bothered. Some people are bothered. Yeah, including Prime Minister Abe in Japan, because the missiles could reach Japan. And Trump said, I'm not bothered by it. I still think that North Korea wants to be a prosperous country and they'll make a deal with me. And so, yeah, that was, you know, Trump's style. But note, Prime Minister Abe just took it pretty much quietly. He wants good relations with Donald Trump.
Yes, I agree. But what came across really not, you know, of course, what he talked, what he said about the missiles and so on, you know, it alarmed a lot of people and alarmed definitely the Japan and Japanese officials as it ought to. But also, I mean, what he said about Kim Jong-un, you know, what he said about him saying about Biden and all these things, that those are the issues that highlighted the visit.
Oh, that would be, well, let's go over that quote for a second. Yeah. The president pointed out, first he did it on Twitter and then said it to a microphone, that Kim Jong-un, it really was North Korea's news agency once, described Joe Biden as a low IQ individual. And on that, I agree with him. Look at Biden's record. Biden's been a disaster. You don't usually say those things about a political rival, a former vice president, when you're overseas.
Right.
But Mr. Trump breaks all the rules.
He does that. And this dovetails into this other sort of bizarre issue where you had a White House directive to cover up, obscure a warship that had former Senator John McCain, who died recently and became an adversary somehow of President Trump. Again, this sort of breaking the norms of criticizing and going after an American war hero, a former senator.
Now, technically, you know that ship was named for the late senator and his father and his grandfather, who were all Navy officers.
I don't think he's taking it that way.
But either way, but the president later did not apologize and say it was a bad idea. He said, I had nothing to do with it. I wouldn't have ordered that. But whoever thought of that idea to cover McCain's name while I visit the base in Japan, he meant well. He was well-intentioned. So it didn't bother Donald Trump as an idea.
It is a scandal. It's a bigger scandal than our reactions suggest, I think. I mean, you're talking about a U.S. ship in foreign waters, you know. I mean, it's right there. You want to cover the name of the ship, you know. I mean, that's the flag that it's flying. This ship has been involved, you know, in conflict. It has sailors. They made them, you know, take out the people that are wearing USS McCain on their hat.
But Trump said, when it comes to McCain, I'm not a fan.
He's not a fan. I mean, the incident itself is really scandalous.
It is. We have just about 1 minute here, and I just wanted to go over very quickly. There was an announcement from the White House that the U.S. Would be imposing tariffs on Mexico as a penalty for allowing these large groups of immigrants coming through Mexico to the U.S. border from Central America.
It was a Thursday night surprise. Let's punish Mexico with a 5% tariff on everything made in Mexico.
And so really, again, we just have 1 minute. I just want a quick statement from you guys. When we look at China trade policy, where you have tariffs, you have Mexico tariffs, it seems to be the one cudgel that the administration is willing to wield. Is it a good idea or is it a bad idea? 30 seconds.
It's a bad idea because it hurts the American consumer. It hurts American farmers. You know, it hurts people who are trading with Mexico. And it hurts the new deal between Canada, the United States, and Mexico.
A new trade deal that Congress supposedly will take up soon, and that the legislatures in Canada and Mexico are considering. And then now President Trump wants to punish Mexico. It's disruptive, but two things to say. The president has described himself as a tariffs man. He doesn't apologize. Right. And he's described himself as a disruptor. And that's what we see every week right here in the studio.
Indeed. That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks so much to Dan Revive, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and Saeed Erekat, Washington bureau chief at Al-Quds Daily Newspaper. This program is produced by Patrice Martin. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.